We're starting a new class. I'll give you a little bit of background on why we're doing this class. So after I finished my seminary work, I took like 2 years off of studying anything because I was so burned out and didn't want to do anything. But recently I've been kind of getting the itch to dig into something again. And one of the things that I'm interested in is church history. And so I started doing some work on the early church, and it kind of naturally led me back to what happened before the early church. And I realized that I had a pretty big gap in my understanding of what happened in the intertestamental period. And so I kind of started doing some digging and doing some study on that. And this course kind of is coming out of that study. So I figured if I have a gap there, probably many other people are maybe fuzzy on this area as well. So I think this is going to be a little bit of an unusual Sunday school class, sort of an unusual topic for Sunday school, but hopefully it'll be fun and profitable. When I started getting into this topic, I found it quite difficult. There's a lot of things to study during this period, and I found it difficult to kind of get my arms around it and bring it together. That's kind of happened. It's like finally kind of clicked for me the last few weeks, and I'm finding it enjoyable now. It was very surprising to me, though, how many rabbit trails there are to go down during this period. And I've gone down a few of them, and I'm going to take you down a few of them during this class, but not too many. But we'll do a few excursuses throughout the class. And one of the things that's a little bit unusual for me is I'm still studying this period. And so I don't have normally when I teach a class like this, I've got it laid out from beginning to end. I know how many lessons there's going to be. I know exactly what's going to happen. In this case, I'm still working on it. So the outline that I'll show you here is pretty well set, but I'm probably going to take some deviations as I learn more because I'm continuing to work on this material. Today, mainly we're going to be doing an introduction. So it's sort of a lengthy introduction to the material. So we probably won't get into too much of the meat yet today. We'll see how far we get, but it's going to be mostly introductory material today. To kick it off, what we're doing is looking at the period between the Testaments, and so the intertestamental period. I've used IT for short throughout, so if you see that, that's what IT means. It doesn't mean computer stuff. It means intertestamental. And so we're looking at the period of time between the Testaments. So the Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi, and then the New Testament begins with the book of Matthew, and we're looking at the period in between those two. And this period is often called the 400 silent years. So why is it called silent? No books, right? There were no books of the Bible specifically. Some of the historians make jokes about it and say this was anything but a silent period, but it was silent in the sense that we don't have any books of the Bible coming to us from this period. And so if we try to figure out why is that 400 silent years, if you just look at the book of Malachi, it was possibly written in around 435 BC. And then if we come up to the beginning of the New Testament, where we have John the Baptist coming on the scene around AD 26, if you just do that math, it's about 460 years. So 400 years is kind of a nice round number that people use. And so we're going to take a look at Malachi here. Just to kind of bookend the study here, let me turn to the last verses of Malachi. I wonder if you've noticed this, what we're going to look at here. But if you look at Malachi chapter 4, in the very last verses, in verse 4 it says, "Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and rules that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction." So when the pages of the New Testament open, what do we find? What's the first thing that we find when we look at the New Testament? Genealogies, in terms of historically, what is the first historical event that we find? John the Baptist. Okay? And so it's interesting to see how the Old Testament closes with this prophecy of, I'm going to send you the Elijah the prophet, before the great and awesome day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children. And so when we go to the New Testament, we find exactly this. And so if we, I wonder if you guys know also, I'm throwing out lots of quizzes here. What book of the New Testament brings us the earliest historical record? This is just like a trivia. Good try. We have Mark over here. I don't think that's right. Matthew starts off with genealogies. I didn't do any study on this exactly, but I think Luke of the Gospels, Luke actually starts with the birth of not Jesus, but John the Baptist. So I think it's historically a little bit earlier. So we've got this prophecy at the end of Malachi, and then what do we find in Luke? So if we turn to Luke chapter 1, and if we pick up in verse 11, we have the story here of Zechariah the priest, who was, if you remember, was on duty in the temple. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. And he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just to make ready for the Lord a people prepared." I wonder if you've ever noticed that direct tie-in before. It makes you wonder if Zechariah recognized those words. I'm sure he did, being a priest ministering in the temple. That he probably heard the words of Malachi there, and what the angel was telling him. And so we've got this wonderful tie-in of the way the Old Testament ends to the way the New Testament opens. And you remember there's also other things about this. Matthew has things to say about John the Baptist as well. In chapter 11, John the Baptist is called the Elijah to come. And so we have that tie-in there. And then if we turn to Matthew chapter 17, there's actually an explanation that Jesus gives here. In chapter 17, verses 10 through 13, the disciples asked him, that is Jesus, "Then why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he answered, "Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come," and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. "So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. So we have a sort of an authoritative interpretation from Jesus that John the Baptist was fulfilling that prophecy of Malachi back in the Old Testament. And so that's kind of a neat tie-in there between the way the Old Testament closes and the way the New Testament opens. One question that I had when I was looking at this period is, we talk about this 400 silent years as if it's a very unique period of time. And so one of the questions I had was, is it really unique? Was there ever another period where it was silent like this, if we go to the history of Revelation? And I kind of found two ways of looking at this. One way is, the two ways are, the reception of revelation, that is, you know, actually receiving revelation from God, and the second one was the production of revelation, or, you know, writing it down. And so if you just look at the reception of revelation, you think about, well, this is a little bit of a trick question, but where did the reception of revelation begin? If you think of the history of Israel, of course, you could go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, but neglecting that, coming in Noah, and I guess this is a kind of a silly question, but I was thinking about Abraham. So if you start with Abraham and you end with the apostles, was there any other period in there where there was no revelation received from the Lord? I think there was. I'll throw that out there for a question just to see if anybody can think of a time, of a long time, when there wasn't any revelation that we're aware of, at least. Anybody want to hazard a guess? I'll give you a hint. It's another 400-year period. Right, the sojourn in Egypt. As far as we know, there wasn't any revelation in Egypt, pretty much ending with Joseph until Moses came on the scene. And we know from the scriptures that that's about a 400-year period. Genesis and Exodus and in Acts, Stephen's speech in Acts also tell us that that was about a 400-year period. So if you think of the absence of revelation, that's one way to think of it. And there is a comparable period when they were in Egypt. If you think about the production of revelation, though, the production of Scripture, so we know when that started. It started with Moses, and we know about when it ended. We believe the last writings of the New Testament are John's writings, most likely. If you think about that, was there ever a break in the production of revelations, beginning with Moses to the end of the New Testament? The answer is, I don't think there was. I think that if you look at the Old Testament revelation, pretty much from Moses all the way up to the exile, and even through the exile when the prophets were still speaking, it's pretty much a steady stream of revelation that was available to God's people coming through the prophets. And then, of course, we get in the New Testament, you get a lot of written revelation right at a very, in a pretty compact period of time relative to the Old Testament. So this is a special period where there was no word of the Lord for God's people. And we'll see probably in the second half of the course, more likely, how that played out for God's people and how it affected them during the intertestamental period. They tried to fill that gap in various ways. We'll kind of look at some of that later, and when we look at some of the cultural and religious implications of the period. So basically, if we think of it from Moses to the return from the exile, there's a steady stream of revelation, which then stopped at some point, and then it ended when John the Baptist came on the scene in the New Testament. And that's what we find when we open the pages of the New Testament. We're struck with John the Baptist. Okay, so why should we study this period? It's interesting. There wasn't really a course on the intertestamental period in my seminary curriculum. I don't know, Mark, if you had a course on this or if Greg had, but there's not really courses on this. There are some courses online that I found, but I was trying to figure out if I was an anomaly, that I just missed this somehow in my education. There's not a lot of information out there about this in terms of a seminary course. So it's typically a hole in our knowledge of events during the biblical times, and it was a hole in my knowledge. And so we have, you know, we know a lot about the Old Testament, and we know a lot about the New Testament, and we even know quite a bit about church history from the end of the New Testament up into the present day. Probably not as much as we should, but we do know quite a bit about church history. But that gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament is sort of a hole in our knowledge of events during the biblical era. Another reason why it's interesting to study this period is because it's very mysterious. I'm not sure that's the right word, but there's a lot of weird stuff that happened during this period. There's a lot of political intrigue. You can see that if you read the book of Daniel. You can see some of the really bizarre stuff that he's talking about there, and he's actually prophesying before it happened. Very accurately, so accurately that most liberal scholars believe that Daniel wrote after the fact because it was so accurate, the prophecies were so accurate. But there's all kinds of very strange things going on. There's the rise of these Jewish groups like the Zealots that we read about in the New Testament, sort of off to the side a little bit. And we have all kinds of literature, apocryphal literature and apocalyptic literature that was written during this period. And so it's a very kind of bizarre period of time. And so it's makes it for a kind of an interesting thing to study. Another important reason to study this period is that there were some very important literary developments during this period. And so one of those is the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, which happened in Alexandria somewhere in the time in the 200 BC, 200, 250 BC range. And that's an important document because we know that many of the New Testament writers were using that version of the Old Testament as their Bible. And some of the quotations in the New Testament are actually taken from the Greek version of the Old Testament. So sometimes when you try to compare the exact wording of a quotation in the New Testament, you'll go back and you'll look at it and you'll go, that's not what it says. And then you'll see like a little marginal note down at the bottom that says it's the Septuagint translation that they were quoting because that's what they had available to them. So that was an important literary development. There were also a lot of important literary documents produced that tell us about Judaism during this period. And one of the big discoveries of this was the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you've probably heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You might know a little bit about them. That's actually one of the rabbit trails I'm off on now in the background, reading books on the Dead Sea Scrolls now. But there's a lot of important literature that was discovered there that sheds a lot of light on both the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, commentaries on the scriptures, as well as life, what was happening in Judaism at that time. And then, of course, we have the whole Apocrypha. It was pretty much produced in this era of time, and we know how important that is, a significant influence that that has had on the Christian church. It's still in the Roman Catholic canon. Most of the books are still in the Roman Catholic canon, in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And it's even printed in many English Protestant Bibles today still. I have a number of them at home that are Protestant Bibles that have the Apocrypha in them still. So that was produced during this time. And then there's a whole other group of writings, a larger group called Pseudepigrapha, which is generally documents that were produced with famous people as their author. And so they're called pseudonyms, which means, you know, they're purported to be written by some famous Old Testament person, for instance, to gain attention. But they're pseudonyms because they weren't really written by that person. They were written during this period of time. And there's a really large body of literature there. So we're going to be looking at some of these texts later in the course. I'm just bringing to your attention here that there was a lot of stuff going on in literature during this period, which is another good reason to be familiar with this period of time. By the way, please just stop me if you have a question. Mark. How did I get interested in this period? One of the main catalysts for me was Josephus, because I always hear Josephus referenced, and I wanted to know who this guy is and why his books are like this thick. And so that was one thing. And just because I recognized that I had really no knowledge of this period, nothing substantial. And it's pretty important when you get into, you know, like Second Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah, and you start looking at the Persian dynasties and all of that. And then we're going to look at a second here about some of the things that should be surprising when you read the New Testament. They're not surprising to us because we've been taught. But when you go back and you figure out, you ask, how do we know about this, this, and this? It's not in the Old Testament. Well, it's because people have studied the intertestamental periods. It's just interesting. A whole. It's a whole. Yes, Pastor. Right. Yeah, that's right. And one of the courses that I found online that I've used a little, some of the material from it's an expanded version of a New Testament introduction, just like that. Yeah. John? Right. So the question is, was the Roman government established yet? And that's what we're going to go over. So that we're going to go over that in gory detail of all the political history. But the Roman government that we find in the New Testament was developed in the later part of this period. Yeah. And so we're going to go, I haven't got to the outline yet, but we're going to go over that. Yes, Dave. Right, so the comment is, does the long period of silence relate to God's judgment? And I don't have an answer to that. There is certainly a sense that the Israelites were being judged during this period. And there's a strong judgment theme, both in the New Testament. So when Jesus comes on the scene, you heard the last verses of Malachi. There's an aspect of judgment there when the Messiah is going to appear. He's coming in righteousness and in setting things right in a way. So there is a sense that God's judgment is coming and happening in the New Testament era. And a lot of the literature in the intertestamental period is focused on judgment and apocalyptic kind of themes and things like that. So, you know, what was God doing during that time is one of the questions we want to try to ask ourselves as we go through this, but there is a judgmental aspect to it, I would say. Okay, so this might be the final good reason to study this period is because it provides context for the New Testament. And I just mentioned that a little bit. So studying any kind of history is usually important to us because we know as Christians that history isn't just brute facts, if you will. It's always interpreted through the lens of what God is doing, because we know that God is providentially controlling all of history. And even during the dark times, we know that God is providentially controlling it. So any period of study is helpful, but this one in particular sets us up to have a better understanding of the New Testament and the expansion of the church. And so I want to take a look here for a second. One of the things that I'm reading through Luke right now, just in my personal reading, and it struck me as I opened the pages of Luke, how many things that he refers to, the only reason I know what they mean is because I have some knowledge already, because I've been taught, of the intertestamental period. So think with me for a second. Imagine yourself, you know, you know the Old Testament, and you come to the end of the Old Testament with that knowledge, and then all of a sudden you open the New Testament. What are some things in the New Testament that you're struck with that are very different and maybe you have no knowledge of from the Old Testament, from where you left off in the Old Testament? Just think about a few here, and then we're going to look at some of them in Luke. Yes, Mark. Baptizing people. Right. That's a good one. What else? Think pretty broadly, like just think of your New Testament knowledge. Think of the Gospels especially. Oh, and not even the Gospels. Think about Acts and Paul's ministries. What are some things that we are struck with in the New Testament that, I know it's kind of hard for us to put ourselves in this position because we have been taught. Kathy? Gentiles are included. Well, that's kind of happened during the New Testament era, right? Yeah. The Messiah, right. Robin? Miracles, yeah. Right. Mark. Roads and commerce. So there's a lot of things to pick off of that one if you let your mind go there. Yes, Pastor. Right. Yeah, the context of really what we're talking about there is the context of the Roman Empire, the Pax Romana, the Roman roads, like Mark was saying. Okay. Dave, you have one more? Mm-hmm. Right. And Jesus coming with forgiveness, sort of a real forgiveness is the fullness of time has come. So the prophecies are being fulfilled. So I'm not going to turn to all these passages, but like I said, I was reading in Luke, and I just started writing down little every little reference that I came across. And so I'll just list these off for you if you want to, if you're writing on your outline, I'll give you the reference. But in one, so these are all in Luke. Chapter 1, verse 5, right at the beginning of the book, we're met with Herod, king of Judea. You know, who's Herod? From the Old Testament, right? A king of Judah. In 2:1, we're met with Caesar Augustus. So there's the Roman reference, a Roman emperor in the census that is happening at that time. In 2:25, we read of Simeon, who was waiting for the consolation of Israel. What does that mean? Waiting for the consolation of Israel. That expectation grows out of the intertestamental period. We'll see that as we come in a little while. 2:27, we find reference to the temple courts, the courts of the temple. We kind of read over that, you know, the temple courts. We might not realize that the temple courts were being rebuilt at that very time by Herod. And actually, it was in process, a very long process of rebuilding the temple. So that temple court that's referred to there, we know it's Second Temple Judaism, but it's actually the temple being restored by Herod, which we know about from the intertestamental period. And we see references to it in the New Testament as well when the folks are marveling at the construction of the temple and the walls. 2:38, chapter 2, verse 38, we read about those who were looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem. The redemption of Jerusalem. In chapter 3, we're met with, at the opening verses of chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, there's several political figures mentioned. We know that Luke was very good at giving us good methods of dating when different political figures were in office, which is a help actually to secular historians as well to date things. In 3 verse 12, we're met with tax collectors. And who are these tax collectors? And that is something that came out of the Roman rule. In 3 verse 15, again, we're told about people who are waiting for the Messiah to come. And then in chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, we read about another Herod, Herod the Tetrarch and Herodias. And that was in conjunction with John the Baptist, if you remember. In Luke chapter 4, here we're met the first time we read about a synagogue. And we actually have this very interesting incident where Jesus reads from the scroll in the synagogue. And that was a practice that was developed during the intertestamental period, as well as the whole synagogue idea, which was happening during the exile. And then in chapter 5, verse 17, we have the first reference to the Pharisees and teachers of the law. And who were the Pharisees? And, you know, we learn later about Sadducees and zealots and things like that. Who were these people? They're not in the Old Testament. I don't know if you recognize that, but it's kind of if you think back, there's no mention of a Pharisee in the Old Testament. So we've got all of these new things. And then finally, in chapter 7, we read about a centurion. So we know that the centurion, we know that it's tied to the Roman rule. But the interesting thing about it is he's a centurion who loved the nation of Israel and built a synagogue for the Jews. And if you're like me, you just read over that and you think, oh yeah, this was one of those God-fearers who helped the Jews. But when you look at back in context, especially with the Jewish and Gentile relations during that period, it's quite an amazing statement to make that a centurion would love the nation of Israel and build a synagogue for them. So there's all these very interesting things that we just kind of gloss over when we read the New Testament because we've read it dozens of times and we've kind of read the notes in our study Bible to figure things out. But when you kind of take a step back and you look at it, the study of the intertestamental period sheds light on all of these things that I just mentioned. And we have the benefit of scholars who have done this for us in our study Bible notes. But it is profitable to look back and do it for ourselves as well. Any questions or comments on that briefly? Okay. And then It's still talking about the context of the New Testament. The Old Testament, so examples, there's more examples. The Old Testament closes under Persian rule. The New Testament opens under Roman rule. How did that happen? How did this transition from Persian rule ultimately to Roman rule affect the context of Jesus' ministry? Many features of Jesus' day are not found in the Old Testament. We already mentioned some of these synagogues, scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, the Herodians, the Sanhedrin. We find the chief priests acting in judgment in roles of judges, if you think about Jesus' trial. How did all of that stuff happen? It's not really in the Old Testament. We see the rise of all the religious groups that are important in the New Testament because Jesus and then later Paul interacted with a lot of these Jewish groups in detail. And we see some hints in the New Testament as to what their beliefs are. For instance, we see some editorial comments in the New Testament about the differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which Paul exploits on occasion when he's on trial. So, but an understanding of all of these things happens when we study the intertestamental period. And also just think about understanding the context of the New Testament, the context of Jesus' ministry, what those people had been through. What were their expectations and their hopes and their struggles at that particular time? Some of the reactions that we see in the New Testament to different things, like the interactions with the Samaritans, for instance. A lot of that reaction that we see in the New Testament is because of what happened 100 years, 200 years before. So it's quite interesting to see those connections. And then, of course, studying this period helps us to understand the political history and the religious situation at the advent of John the Baptist and Jesus. And so I think there's lots of good reasons to study this. That was sort of my apologetic for why it's good to study this period. And then the next thing I have on the outline is some of the characteristics of this period. Some of the things that, if we look in broad general scope, what was this period like? And I've got four things there. First of all, it's a period of tremendous political upheavals and military campaigns and conquests going on. There's several different empires that rose and fell during this period of time. That military and political upheaval brought massive cultural changes. And for the followers of the true God, it brought many challenges, cultural challenges, religious challenges. If we can put ourselves back in that time period, it's not that different from some of the challenges that we face today with how we should react to political and governmental things that are going on around us. And so there were also a lot of religious struggles and developments within Judaism happening at this period of time. And that's reflected in a lot of the writings that I mentioned earlier. There were all kinds of interesting things going on within Judaism, developments really within Judaism, that again leads us up to the New Testament context. And then finally, we mentioned this earlier, there was a lot of judgmental kind of themes in this period. There were some pretty strong messianic expectations, a lot of eschatological themes, looking to the end times, interpreting the difficulties that they were going through in this period, and then against the prophecies of restoration, for instance, at the end of Malachi, and then projecting that into sort of an eschatological fulfillment in the future. There's a lot of that kind of thinking in this time period. A lot of apocalyptic kind of writings that are here. So there is definitely a strong theme there of this waiting and expectation. God is going to do something here. And there's an expectation. For instance, I mentioned I'm studying the Dead Sea Scrolls right now. The Qumran community very much believed that they were living in the final generation before the deliverance was going to occur. So you see a lot of strong themes of the messianic type themes, confused messianic themes, but messianic themes in this period. So it's a very, very interesting period. You can see from this where some of the bizarre, mysterious part of it comes out from all the stuff that was happening during this period. Okay. Any questions on that before we go into the approach? First Jen and then Jim. Yeah, that's a good point. And what you said reminded me of the words in Peter too about the expectation of the Lord's coming and that he's patient. You know, we live in that not yet still as well in a different sense, but an expectation of the second coming that we have. And we shouldn't be loath to think that God is not going to keep his promises. Okay, so the approach that we're going to take here is, I wanted to talk a little bit about this because I mentioned before that I found this period quite difficult because of the broad scope of everything and all the things that were going on. And I came across this paragraph about the difficult work of a historian, and it really applies to this. You know, doing history is difficult anyways, but particularly in this era, I'll talk about some of the challenges here, but like Greg said, this book is by Merrill Tenney called New Testament Times. And so a lot of you'll find a lot of things in the New Testament introduction that talks about this period. It pretty briefly, usually, because it's usually just an introductory chapter into New Testament study. One of the things that I've enjoyed doing this study is kind of reacquainting myself with some good old favorites. Merrill Tenney is a good New Testament scholar, and F.F. Bruce, I'm reading some of his books too, because he's a scholar on the books and the parchments, the canon of Scripture and stuff. It's been fun to reread some of these guys after a long time off. I want to read to you the first paragraph here about how it's difficult to do history. And so he says here, "History is the autobiography of mankind. Written by learned and ignorant alike, it is contained in inscriptions carved on monuments, in the clay tablets of Babylonia, in the fragile papyrus sheets exhumed from the sands of Egypt, in broken potsherds from the ruins of Palestine, and in the scrolls and manuscripts that caves and monasteries have yielded to the patient research of the antiquarian. The task of collecting, interpreting, and evaluating these records belongs to the historian, who seeks to construct from their fragmentary and often conflicting testimony an orderly and coherent account of what really happened. The problem of being completely accurate is in itself colossal, for the evidence is often scant and may have been expressed in an unfamiliar idiom. Broken sequences of chronology and of cause and effect are frequent. The undertaking is further complicated by the bias, unconscious or purposeful, inherent in the available sources. Was the original writer truthful, or was he merely a propagandist for some forgotten cause? Did he have full knowledge of the events he described, or was he dependent upon some other source which may have been falsified or mistaken? An aspiring historian must be able to discriminate between truth and error, and between objective fact and tendentious propaganda." So, a lot of the things that he mentioned there are very relevant to this period of time because the sources are pretty scant in some cases, and I'll talk about this in a second, but notice what he said there. There's a wide variety of material. There's inscriptions, there's tablets, papyrus sheets, potsherds, which is broken pottery with things written on them, or maybe things that help us to date the contents of what was in the pot. We've got leather manuscripts that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and all this wide variety of evidence that we need to use for source material. And because it's in that form, it's very fragmentary. And sometimes it conflicts too, and that's one of the things that you'll find in the intertestamental period. There's conflicting accounts. One of my frustrations when I started reading this, I started with secondary sources to kind of get the broad lay of the land, and I was frustrated because there were conflicts between the secondary sources. One guy said this, I read another source, and he completely something different about an interpretation of an event. And as I dug into it more, I realized it's because the source material is very confusing. And there's contradictions in the source material. Or maybe you only have one source and there's no other reference to check the accuracy of that source against. And so we have to make interpretations of what really happened. And so this fragmentary and conflicting evidence is very true in the intertestamental period. He mentioned languages and idioms. Did you catch that? Languages and idioms that are not well understood. Imagine if somebody 500 years from now tried to understand our writings and our slang and use of idioms and stuff with the translation has been lost. So there's a lot of things like that that are not well understood. He mentioned broken sequences of chronology. So you have what happened in what order, and you have some of that is cause and effect relationships. And if you don't have an accurate piecing together of what things happened where, you can't judge cause and effect. You can't figure out what the chronology really was. This actually, we'll study this later when we look at persecution of the Jews in Jerusalem under the Seleucid dynasty. There's some very conflicting information about the cause and effect of what happened there that led up to the Maccabean period. And then maybe the most important thing he mentioned there is the bias of the source. So basically, does the guy who was writing this have an agenda or not? And if so, what was his agenda? How do we figure out if he had an agenda? How do we even know if he had an agenda? Was he truthful, or was he trying to argue for, be a propagandist for some point that he was trying to make? And then the other thing he mentioned is, was he knowledgeable about the event himself, or was he dependent on another source? And then how accurate was that source? And what was the source, first of all? And then secondly, was it accurate or not? Think about if you tried to write a history of the American Revolution. How would you do that? Were you and I, we're not eyewitnesses of it. So we go back to sources and then, you know, just think about a simple case like that, which was only 200 years ago. And we have pretty good sources for it. But even in the sources we have, there's a lot of biases, and you've heard the maxim that the winner gets to write the history. So that's very true as well. So if it's that difficult for us, imagine how difficult it was for some of the people back then with very scant written things to depend upon. And then what biases are present in the sources that we're looking at? We have to take all of that into account when we're trying to get what really happened, as Merrill Tenney says. We're just about out of time. I think I'll try to close with this. There's several aspects which make this era particularly challenging to study. I've mentioned that there's a large amount of complex material to work through. There's also a lot of recent development emerging still. The Dead Sea Scrolls, believe it or not, are still being analyzed, and there's still new things coming out of that that bring to light new interpretations of the Judaism of that day. There's a lot of emerging material. What I found when I started this out is it's very difficult to get a handle on this if you're not an expert already. It's very difficult for a layman to get a good picture of this era. Much of the historical material is heavily biased. You'll find that for sure when you look at the source material. And the problem is not that the things are biased necessarily, but that there's limited perspectives available to identify the biases. That's one of the main problems here. Josephus is an excellent example of that. He's one of the premier historians of the intertestamental period. It's well known that he had some biases and was trying to write to make himself look good in certain cases. But there's very little other material to test what he's saying. And so we're kind of stuck with trying to figure that out on very limited information. And we're going to look at Josephus in detail in a few weeks. Much of the scholarship of this period is liberal also. That's not necessarily always bad, but some cases here, it really colors the interpretation of the period. For instance, a lot of people, I mentioned Daniel earlier. Most liberal scholars don't accept that Daniel was written early, so they'll say that Daniel was written after the period, after the events occurred, and you can imagine how that might slant your interpretation of the events, whether Daniel was writing predictively or whether he was writing after the fact. And some people will even say that he got some things wrong. Writing after the fact now, he got some things wrong. So some of that is very difficult to muddle through. Another good example of that is discussions of Solomon's temple and the accompanying worship in the temple is seen by being colored by the post-exilic experience. Because all of this stuff was written way late, it's all colored by the experience of people that were writing after the exile. And so you see this sort of twisted view of even what was happening in under the monarchy in Israel. And so it just makes it hard to trust some of these sources. There's good historical information in there, but whenever they try to interpret something, it can be tricky to figure it out. Another good example is that prophets, you know, there's a lot of prophetic material that relates to this material. And you'll see things that the interpretation is that the prophet was only speaking on human authority. You know, he's just a human being writing books of the Bible. You know, like Daniel, for instance. He's just a human being writing a book, or maybe it wasn't even Daniel that wrote it, most likely in these cases. So there seem to be an error if their statements don't make sense to the liberal mind. For instance, if they don't have a good understanding, no connection of the purpose of the exile, for instance, spiritually. No concept of being prepared for the Messiah. No concept of the spiritual nature of the kingdom of God. And so you can imagine when these people are writing interpretively about this period and they don't have even that fundamental understanding of what was happening in the Old and then subsequently in the New Testament, it really colors the material. And then finally, I'll end with this, the lack of quality accessible material for the non-specialists. So, and Jim has mentioned another book by N.T. Wright that's helpful here. There's a lot of books out there, but I couldn't find one that really tied it all together very well, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to delve into it myself and read the primary sources and try to summarize it. So these are all challenging aspects of this period that I've run into.